AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction. This AgriTalk podcast is brought to you by Acuron corn herbicide from Syngenta, which delivers 5 to 15 more bushels an acre than any other herbicide. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron Yield Advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and university trials. You probably already know that there are currently over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage. If you're a farmer, that gives you over 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support ethanol. Learn more at poet.com/ag. We are doubling up on the outlook this morning, covering soybeans and the energy markets. And just ahead of the next update of the supply and demand tables from USDA, soybean futures are leading a push to the upside, and wheat is a willing follower, while corn, despite good export news, is once again underperforming.
Live from the last 10th Thursday of 2020 via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, we continue our Outlook series with Chad Hart from Iowa State University. Then it's a discussion on energies with Phil Flynn from the Price Futures Group. And right after the news, Greg Henderson from Drovers. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. And now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
All right, Davis, thank you so much. Beautiful day yesterday. And we're
gorgeous.
Getting a carbon copy repeat of it today.
Mm-hmm. Woo! Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Unbelievable. 10th of December. Mm-hmm. And here it is. Oh, 10th of December. Yeah, we got supply and demand reports coming up here in a little under an hour.
That's right.
We'll do a bit of a preview for the soybean balance sheet with Chad, but we're going to look beyond this report. We're looking deeper into the year when we get Chad on the line, and looking forward to that conversation with him. And then with these energy markets, Davis, I know that you follow the energies very, very closely, but I try to follow them as well. I don't know if I've ever been more confused on the direction of which way these markets are going right now than I am right now.
I agree. And, maybe he's not the best representative of the overall opinion, but Bubba has talked about how, you know, some of these markets have just decoupled from reality and the fundamentals are having less and less impact on the futures markets. And I think crude oil is no exception. So it's good to have Phil Flynn on to get some perspective. He's great.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the crude oil market in particular, I think, is a great example of the struggles of a market to reflect what is happening right now at this moment and reflect what is going to happen in the future, at least anticipation of what is going to happen in the future.
Well, you don't ask for much, do you? You want to know what's happening right now and you want to know what's happening in the future all from one market?
Something about cake and eating it too is coming to mind. I don't know what that all means. It's the holidays. That's what I'm thinking.
There you go. Chalk it up to holiday trade.
Love it. Love it. All right. Let's get to it. What you got in the news, man?
Well, according to Glenn Hubbard, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush, the U.S. economic outlook is becoming less rosy. Hubbard wrote for the Wall Street Journal, quote, yes, the economy added jobs in November and the unemployment rate fell to 6.7%, but the pace of job gains is notably slower. Consumer spending is slowing. Consumer confidence is weakening. Household savings have plummeted since April as consumers burn through savings. After a remarkable recovery this spring, a double dip recession is in the cards. See, Chip.
Okay, it's either a double dip, and I'm not going to argue that too much. I mean, I'm not going to argue period with Glenn Hubbard, but the household savings rate, it's boy, that's, you want to talk about a K shape. The household saving rate is definitely a K shape. If we are fortunate enough to continue to have a job, savings rate for that group of the workforce is going up. For the other group in the workforce that is out of a job right now, obviously, the household savings are going down. We're splitting up the classes again. It's scary. Yep.
Well, Joe Biden is expected to name House Ways and Means Committee Chief Trade Lawyer Katherine Tai to be the U.S. Trade Representative, a person familiar with plans, told the New York Times. From 2007 to 2014, Tai worked for the Office of the United States Trade Rep, where she successfully prosecuted several cases on Chinese trade practices at the WTO. If confirmed, Tai, who is Asian American, would be the first woman of color to serve as the U.S. Trade Representative, Chip.
Yeah, Wiesmeyer's reaction to this so far is very favorable. Jim Wiesmeyer, mm-hmm. from Pro Farmer, his reaction is favorable. I don't know that much about her, but she's got the experience to get the job done.
And we'll get into this more deeply with Phil, but here's some groundwork on energies. The U.S. Energy Information Administration reported the largest crude oil build on record last week. Inventories rose 15.2 million barrels during the weekend of December 4 on a glut of imports amid tepid demand. Meanwhile, the U.S. exported the most LNG on record last month, 9.4 billion cubic feet per day, after recovering from a slowdown because of the coronavirus. So wow. there's your fundamentals for you.
Yeah, we'll get into that later.
Farms in two additional Chinese prefectures have detected bird flu, bringing the total number of prefectures infected to 8 out of 47. All chicken farms have been ordered to undertake disinfection and to check hygiene regimes and ensure nets installed to keep wild birds out of domestic operations are properly installed. Japan had already culled 2.36 million birds before the two latest outbreaks, Chip.
Yeah, this is nothing to mess with. I mean, we've had to deal with bird flu in this country. They've dealt with it in Asia, yep. all over the place. This is scary stuff. They get it handled, Japan. Get it isolated.
The House has voted to keep the government funded through December 18, and the Senate will act on that measure today. Talks continue on another COVID aid package. And this quickly, USDA will increase practice incentive payments for installing practices from 5% to 20% for new enrollments in CRP, with the increase tied to the deployment of software enhancements for fiscal 2021. Producers will receive a 10% incentive payment for water quality practices on new CRP enrollments under the water quality initiatives. Once those software enhancements are deployed, USDA opened continuous CRP signup December 9. That was yesterday. Chip.
Yep. So if you're already doing some of those practices, hide them so that you can report them as you're doing them new so that you can get paid for it later.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Okay, great. Good stuff. Thank you, Davis. Let's bring in Greg Henderson, editorial director at Drovers. It's like the old Endangered Species Act, right? Greg, when you saw one on your ground, what'd you do?
That's right, Chip.
Drove it away.
Exactly. That's right.
Yep. Hey, man. Okay, so after talking with Don Close yesterday, after talking with Casey Schumacher from Western Nebraska yesterday, this weather situation, Greg, the drought is going to have an impact on calf numbers.
Yes, absolutely. So what we're seeing projected now, Chip, is we could possibly be at the highest level of beef cow culling since 2012. You remember in the midst of that huge drought we were in. So they're talking about the cow culling forecast being at 11% next year. That would be another 0.5% higher than this year. So that National Drought Monitor is showing those conditions worsening in the West, and the fallout is just evident. So also, 2021 is going to be the third year of contraction of the cow herd, and analysts say that we're probably going to be at about 31 million cattle this year. So that should be good news for cow-calf producers, provided you have the feed and forage resources to maintain a cow herd, right?
Yeah, because those forage prices are going up right now.
Yeah, all of their costs are going up right now. Yep. So it would be good if we actually see some increase in calf prices next year. And there's thinking that they're going to be steady to higher next year. It's not going to be a big rally, Chip.
Gotcha. Thank you, Greg. That's Greg Henderson from Drovers. We've got Chad Hart up next on AgriTalk.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Performance Beef, easy-to-use cattle management software.
It's that time of the year again. It's a good time for growers to look back and evaluate the season, what worked, what didn't. I'm joined today by Steve Gumm. He is corn herbicide product lead with Syngenta. Steve, how can growers set themselves up to find more corn bushels in 2021?
Well, first and foremost, know your corn crop's opponents. In this example, it's key problem weeds. Early season weeds are yield robbers, Chip, so it's important to know which weeds are present in your fields and their individual strengths and weaknesses. With that information, you can make well-informed decisions about agronomic practices and your herbicide program.
Okay, so it's 2021. I know what weed pressures I'm facing, and I have carefully picked my herbicide or my herbicides. If I'm a corn grower, what should be my next goal as far as weed control?
Well, starting clean with an effective burn down and a pre-emergence residual corn herbicide like Acuron, and then staying clean throughout the season is really important. Multiple effective sites of action help ensure quality weed control and prevent the spread of resistance, while overlapping residuals help extend control to crop canopy or beyond.
All right, so I know you're going to recommend Acuron here because it offers maximum weed control and preserves that top end yield potential, doesn't it?
Yeah, we all have brands that we like and we are willing to pay for, right? And usually we're okay with paying that little bit more because we appreciate the return on our investment. My go-to is Acuron because it's the only corn herbicide that unlocks corn's full yield potential. And when we apply it pre-emergent at the full use labeled rates, replicated Syngenta and University trials show Acuron out-yields competitors by 5 to 15 bushels an acre.
Yeah, that's so important in this time when we're looking for to maximize our revenue potential. You got to do everything you can, and 5 to 15 bushels an acre matters. All right. Thank you, Steve. That was Steve Gomm, corn herbicide product lead with Syngenta, talking to us about how you can find more bushels in 2021. To find out what an extra 5 to 15 bushels per acre with Acuron corn herbicide could mean for your revenue potential, try Syngenta's online calculator at findmorebushels.com or talk to your local Syngenta retailer. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron yield advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and University trials.
Right now, there are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage, waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues, like climate change. But exports are unreliable and have been flat for 30 years. So how do we utilize all that corn while ensuring dependable markets right here at home? POET is working hard to increase the amount of ethanol in the nation's fuel supply from 10 to 15%. Nationwide, adoption of E15 would generate almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year, which is the equivalent of nearly doubling corn exports by increasing domestic markets that can't be taken away. That's 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support higher blends of ethanol. It's time for farmers to unite around E15. Biofuels like ethanol are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture will change the world. Learn more about what you can do to support Nationwide E15 at poet.com/ag.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free Resource Stewardship Planning Guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
I just want everybody out there to know that I had this guy picked out to deliver the soybean outlook in the AM Agri Talk as we get to the end of the year and we take a long look forward. Even before the Cyclones won the Big 12 regular season.
Here we go.
That, I had Chad picked out for it. But even with that said, how about them Cyclones, Chad?
How about them Cyclones? Number one in the Big 12. We've never got to say that before, so we got to say that loud and strong.
We've never been able to say it, and I think it was 108 years since we could claim a conference championship, and I think that was like the Missouri Valley or something like that.
That is correct, sir. We got to claim it in 1911 and 1912.
Yes, and I would remind that the First World War ensued. I don't know if there was a connection or not, but...
I was just waiting to see if you would bring it up versus the pandemic, because it's roughly the same time period.
That's right. That's right. Yep, Spanish flu. Yep, it takes that, I guess. All right. Chad, thanks for being here. It's Chad Hart from Iowa State University, Extension Ag Economist there. He specializes in crops marketing. Chad, thanks for joining us. Glad you're here, man.
My pleasure.
Okay, so let's stay really short for just a moment or two. The average trade guess for this morning's supply and demand report that's out in like 40 minutes is for a 2020-21 bean carryover of about 170 million bushels, down 20 million bushels from last month. Is that pointed in the right direction, do you think?
I believe it is, and it's all basically trying to read the tea leaves of what's happening in the export market. And all signals there point to the number continuing to grow.
Okay. So USDA in November had that export number at 2.2 billion bushels. That was unchanged from October, but nonetheless, it still feels kind of aggressive compared to the previous years. But we got to remember that we're comparing to restricted trade in the U.S.-China trade TIF, right?
Yeah, and you've also got to remember what we've already done thus far. When you look at export sales, we're up there about $1.9 billion already. So you're only talking about $300 million through the rest of the marketing year. And in a normal year from this point forward, we would gain somewhere between 400 to 500 million bushels at least. So just based upon normal trends, you get there.
Wow. 400 to 500 million. Well, that would explain why Steve Fried from ADMIS yesterday was talking about a 2.4 billion bushel export effort for 2020-21. If we do that, Chad, we're going to have to move beans around from one sector to another, right?
We would. And that's the big issue, I think, looking forward here, especially here in the short term, is we're getting that stocks number down to the level where you are talking about trading bushels from one category to another just because you're starting to run out of bushels.
So that is when we start. That's the definition of getting to pipeline supplies, right?
It is. That's when you're really getting down to it, because you can't create anymore. You've got to just shift from the existing supplies.
So I'm not going to tell you what Steve said that level was. Have you gotten, what's your thoughts on what that pipeline level is?
Well, I that's the deal. I think when we're looking here, we're talking probably somewhere in the, I'm going to say, 120 to 180 range when we look there. And it really depends here upon, you've got two big swings that can happen here. One, you were sort of bringing it up in the previous session. When we're looking at, you know, livestock situation, the feed situation there, how that pulls versus what's happening with China on the export side.
Right.
Those are the two big pockets where the beans are already dedicated, and you know which one of those blinks first to make a little room.
Right. Okay, just to put a bow on that pipeline conversation, yesterday Steve said 140 million bushels. That was in the afternoon show, if anybody wants to go listen to that. So, you know, and he's very concerned about the possibility that we could see some of these carryover projections well below that level, but eventually then you have to have a price that gets you back to that pipeline level, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's the deal. That's when we start to talk about when's the price start to ration demand out there.
Yep.
Because that, when you get down to these pipeline levels, that's what the price is meant to do.
That's exactly. Okay. Now, with all of that said, it could start raining in Brazil on a consistent basis, and we could erase the crop concerns out of South America, and all of a sudden the urgency in this bean market kind of deflates, right?
Yeah, it's possible, and that's the deal. When you look here, I think one of the big other areas as we're looking forward into 2021, as you mentioned, is the moisture situation. First in South America, but the longer this goes on, the more we have to worry about our own soil situation here, because of the ongoing drought.
Right. Yeah, something that we need to watch very, very closely there. Back to the domestic market here, Chad. Crush in November and October was estimated at 2.18 billion bushels. Do you think that catches it?
I think so. I mean, when I'm looking here and, you know, as I'm looking at mainly the beet, you know, what we're seeing in the meat markets, you know, what we have seen is that that growth, at least in terms of the numbers of animals, starting to slow down. But the pounds that we're still projecting out there for the next 12 months suggest, you know, a steady crush coming on here. But, yeah, I think the number catches it.
Okay. How about the expansion in the crush capacity coming into the Midwest? Iowa, it sounds like, is going to get two, if not three, new crush facilities here in the next couple of years. That's going to have an impact on our ability to build that number, and basis right in the middle of the Corn Belt could improve.
Yep, it could. And so when you're looking here, I think that's especially the case of, you know, farmers have, you know, learned the historical lessons, what we've seen, what ethanol did for the corn market, for example. And yeah, having those crush facilities, more crush facilities in the Midwest does help, you know, help, especially in terms of that, as you mentioned, the basis levels, the cash prices that help solidify that, you know, doesn't necessarily do all that much on the future side necessarily for us, but yeah, tightens up that basis.
Yep. You know, I think that is U.S. Business looking at all the uncertainty down in Argentina and saying, listen, if Argentina isn't going to be a reliable supplier of soybean oil and soybean meal to those countries out there that don't have the crush facilities, we're willing to step up and provide some of that.
Yeah, well, it gives us that flexibility, value added. We can sell you the beans. We can sell you the meal. We can sell you the oil. Tell me what you're looking for. We've got it available on our menu.
Right. Right. Okay. So understanding that there's a lot of uncertainty out there, how many more acres are we going to need for the 2021 crop? I mean, among the analysts that have been on AgriTalk Chat, 4 to 6 weeks ago, we were talking about 3 million more, and then it was 7 million more. And then yesterday, I got 9 million more from Steve Freed. How many more acres do you think we need for the 2021 crop over 2020?
Okay. So now, as you're looking here, 9 million would put you up in that 92 million acre range.
Yep.
Which we've never touched before. Yep. I'm not going to be quite that aggressive. I'm in the 90 to 91 camp.
Okay.
With the thought process being here of, okay, we will do some price rationing as we get deeper here into the 20 marketing year. Think, you know, spring of 2021. That's going to try, you know, and let's face it, the market is trying to bring some acres in. Yeah. And it really becomes a question of figuring out, and this is what we're going to do, I'm going to say, especially as I'm looking at February, I think the trade's going to really concentrate on, do we see those last residual sales on that export market or not? If we do, I think that holds that price up there, and you get closer to 91 million acres out there. But 92 would be a really hard push, I think, especially given the dry conditions, because I think that's another thing that will play into the planting decision.
Right. Right. Absolutely. It will. Absolutely. It will. What does this market look like a year from now? Right. Do you think, Chad?
Well, I mean, let's face it. You look at the futures market right now. We're still holding for the 21 crop out there. Futures are pointing to a $10 season average cash price. It's a signal to bring area in, and it's based upon, okay, we've got this really strong demand out there. We don't see the feed side backing off. We don't see exports backing off. And so if anything, that's putting in a floor right now that could go even higher as we move forward.
Yeah, and then that toss in the uncertainty of the beginning stocks for the 2021-22 marketing year. And you got to give it some incentive to add those acres. Great job, Chad. Appreciate you very much. Let's go Cyclones.
Thank you, sir. Go Cyclones.
All right. Chad Hart, Iowa State University. Phil Flynn up next.
There are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage, waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues, like climate change. Moving from 10 to 15% ethanol nationwide would result in almost 2 billion bushels of new domestic corn demand each year. That means nearly eliminating the need for corn exports by ensuring dependable markets right here at home while driving commodity prices to profitable levels. Biofuels are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture can change the world. Learn more at poet.com/ag.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from ProFarmer.
And joining us right now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Here we are, half an hour away from the December supply and demand report. What's catching your eye in the markets right now?
Well, definite strength across the grain and soy markets. Soybean futures had a strong up day yesterday. Active follow-through buying here today. So as we sit here mid-morning, it looks like potentially a low is in place. We'll see how the market reacts after we get the data this morning from USDA, anticipating that exports will go up and that ending stocks will come down from where they were projected last month. Really, the news, I suppose, is in the wheat market with Russia potentially considering an export tax on wheat shipments. While the quota for the second half of the marketing year has been been talked about, that wouldn't really restrict the exports, but a tariff probably would and take away their competitiveness on the global marketplace.
Right, right. Okay. This corn market had some export news this morning, right?
It did. We had daily sales this morning, so second day in a row to Mexico. We had weekly sales that were, almost 1.4 million tons. Good solid export numbers there to give us some support. Trading about 2 to 3 cents higher, though, was all on the export news.
Okay, plus signs in the cattle complex.
Yeah, really good recovery there. We have backed off session highs, but still showing solid gains. So it's good to see that price recovery. That's in the face of falling box beef prices just continuing to plunge here. The hog market, it's under a little bit of price pressure this morning. Weekly export sales were disappointing there.
Gotcha. That's Brian Grady from Pro Farmer on Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer. For a strong start, trust the tried and true protection of Corvus and harness extra herbicides from Bayer.
Davis, this just in from John Harith, Farm Journal News Director. The yes? nominations of Vilsack, Fudge, and Ty are now official. So it's Vilsack for USDA, Fudge for HUD, and Ty for USTR.
Very good.
So now official. I'll admit, I'm surprised by Vilsack. We'll talk more about it tomorrow on the free-for-all, which, by the way, is going to feature Representative Cindy Axne.
Yeah, I saw that.
From that's awesome. Iowa. Yeah. That's going to be a lot of fun having Cindy on the show. Big ethanol supporter and... likes to stay on top of what's going on in the energy markets. And I hope she's listening right now because we've got Phil Flynn, who is the energy analyst at Price Futures Group. He joins us now. Phil, welcome back to AgriTalk. It's great to have you.
It's great to have you. Chip, I can't believe your name was not on that list. Wouldn't you turn him down again? Come on. I thought
my name is on no short list,
sure.
Phil.
Huh? Oh, well, all right, that's all right. Maybe next time,
Maybe next time.
Those guys don't usually last too long anyway.
Right, and there's no guarantee that if asked, I would serve, so we can't forget that.
He'll do it.
Oh, you do it. All right. Well, we'll have everybody write their congressman. This is your time. Get Chip in there. Mm-hmm. Come on, we can get things moving there. All right.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, right. Okay, man. So Davis and I were chatting at the start of the show. I don't know if I've ever been more confused about where energy prices, crude oil prices in particular, might be heading. And let's start on one hand and get your comments here, and that is that we've got this huge weekly build in crude oil inventories. Record 1 week build, right?
Well, it was like the biggest flood of oil I think I've seen since the Poseidon Adventure movie.
Yeah.
You know, where it turned the boats over. It was a shocker, and I don't think anybody was looking for that kind of a number. We had some of the private forecasters that were looking for a build of about 5 million barrels, but every once in a while you get these crazy numbers from the EIA. And people almost immediately dismiss the number because it's so out of whack with what we've been saying. So how do you get these crazy numbers?
Right.
Usually it's a combination of factors. Sometimes it's weather, you know, sometimes it is the holiday, which it was the Thanksgiving weekend, you know, and other times it could be just lagging reports. And I think the combination of the factors, sometimes when you get these week-to-week numbers, are incredible. For example, they reported that during a holiday week that the imports into the United States went up by 1.1 million barrels a day. That's incredible. Okay, that's a huge jump in imports. And at the same time, they said the U.S. exports of oil went to zero. Okay?
Right.
Well, I don't think anybody believes either one of those numbers. We believe that the numbers are probably going to get adjusted in the coming weeks.
Okay.
And even if we did get this big influx of oil, it's going to stop coming because we know that's what's coming out of OPEC, even with their slight increase in production, that they're going to stop sending oil to the United States. So we're not going to get a lot of oil from them. So, you know, we think the tide is going to turn and that increase that you saw last week is probably going to get corrected down next week.
Okay. Well, that was one of the questions that I was going to ask you, Phil, is if the imports that were reported, if it was front-running in front of a slowdown in imports from OPEC plus countries going forward.
It's possible that there was definitely some of that in play. I also think what was in play here, too, is that if you are going to import oil, you got to do it this week, and then you got to start drawing it down because you're going to be taxed on anything you have sitting in inventories at the end of the year. So there's going to be some tax considerations. So you bring in the oil at the end of November because you don't want it on your books at the end of December, because then you're going to have to pay Uncle Sam a little extra money. So there could be a little of that. But I think, you know, really the market reaction to the draw by holding key support and today hitting the highest level since March gives you a better idea of what the market thinks the state of the oil market is. And whenever you get a really bearish number and the market doesn't act bearishly and starts to go up, that should tell you that there's something on the horizon that's starting to be more bullish for the global oil market.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But, Phil, I don't think there's any denying that travel, even though we saw a spike at Thanksgiving, travel between the holidays has just fallen off a cliff. Look at the TSA security checks on a daily basis. We're back to levels that we were looking at in July. And this is people are staying home. We're not using as much right now.
They are. I mean, the Thanksgiving holiday was the lowest travel, I think, in over 10 years. But, you know, we're still a global oil market, okay? And if you look at what's happening around the world, the story's starting to change a little bit.
Yep, okay.
Mainly in Asia. You know, if you look at China right now, you know, they're starting to get traffic jams again. You know, believe it or not, they've had a vaccine that's been out for months. You know, and they didn't have to wait for the government to approve it. They put it out there right away. They were gambling, but it seems to be paying off. And it looks like China's oil demand is through the roof. And the other thing is that even though you're right about the demand side, demand is still going to be restrained. You have seen the biggest hit to the supply side in the history of the oil market, right? I mean, if you look at what OPEC did, you know, along with Russia, you know, they engineered the biggest oil production cut in history. And what was even more amazingly, they hardly cheated at all, right? You know, so they reduced inventories, you know, upwards of 11 million barrels a day. That's huge. That's huge. Okay. Then you look at the U.S., they cut production not because they're a cartel, but because they're going broke. You know, you saw oil production fall by 3 million barrels a day. Now, the other thing is that now you expect, well, oil prices are going back up, it's going to bounce back. That might not be the case, because if you look at the investment in oil for the future, it's not there. We saw some of the biggest cuts in spending expectations in years, and we're starting to see that being priced into the market.
Okay. That's the one hand. All of that was on one hand of one thing that I wanted to talk about. On the other hand, and you already mentioned it, in Asia, the vaccines and the promise that they hold. It feels like the market is trying to balance that out right now. And today you got the Jan contract up $2 right now. It feels like maybe it's looking forward and saying, hey, the vaccine's going to work.
That's what it's saying. I mean, we're definitely saying that. And I think what it's saying even more when it comes to oil is that if it does work, we're not going to be prepared to meet the demand growth that may come back to the market because of the underinvestment.
Yep. Can't ramp up your crude oil supplies fast enough to keep up with the refining, can't refine fast enough to keep up with the demand. All of a sudden, you've got gasoline prices pulling crude higher. Right?
You really do. And I'll tell you another thing, too. I mean, if you look at some of the refiners, we've been closing refineries. And you're not going to reopen those right away. So we're going to have less capacity to ramp. But even if we could ramp up overnight, we're going to have less capacity. You look at the bankruptcies in the shale patch. You know, we've had hundreds of companies declare bankruptcy. That's the most since, 2016. And it's not like people are looking to throw a lot of money in energy. They probably should be because a lot of people are saying we're going to have peak demand in a few years and we're all going to be, driving electric cars. And the reality is that I think we're making a huge mistake in underinvestment in energy, and I think we're going to be paying the price for that, in the next few years.
Complete agreement. And I think listeners know that I am in complete agreement with that, Phil. There's a transition period that makes liquid fuels good for at least 15, 20, 25 years. We can't ignore that time period. Phil, a year from now, holidays 2021, what does the energy markets look like under a Biden administration? Are you there, Phil? Oh, shoot. No,
we didn't lose him. Talk about a cliffhanger. Is he there?
Yeah. Phil, are you there? Oh, we lost him. We just lost him. I thought he was still there. Hopefully, we're going to get him back on here for at least a minute. Mm-hmm. But what he's talking – and you know how I feel about this transition to electric cars. Mm-hmm. Is it going to happen? Probably. But there is so much work that needs to be done to get – if nothing else, get the grid ready to handle it. People just think that we're just going to plug this stuff in. All right, we got Phil back. Great. Thank you, Joe.
Obviously, the Russians don't like what I'm saying, I guess.
We've only got about a minute left, Phil, but I got to ask you, a year from right now, holidays 2021, what do the energy markets look like under a Biden administration?
I think sharply higher. You're going to see more regulations on oil. I think you're going to see a tax on oil, if not directly, but by more regulations with less production. So under a Biden administration, let's face it, people who voted for Biden, they should have realized they're voting for higher energy prices, and I think that's exactly what they're going to get.
Yeah, well, don't you think that they were willing to take that risk? I mean, those that are supporting – I don't know. I think they just think that the money comes from nowhere in many cases.
Well, that's it. That's it. And, I think when you talk about in generalities about, cleaning the environment and, shutting down dirty oil and polluting oil, you've got to look at the balance, the other side. They haven't shown me a fuel that's any cleaner.
Yes.
You can say, well, wind and solar and all this kind of great stuff. They have negative impacts on the environment as well, and they're going to be part of the solution. But at the end of the day, they're not going to be viable or scalable enough to make this transition easy if you start cracking down on fossil fuels. It's going to be a very painful
transition. That's right. Phil Flynn from Price Futures. Thank you.
America's Conservation Ag Movement would like to recognize Sanderson Farms for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
And the other thing here, Davis, is the U.S. Is the U.S. going to be a leader or a follower in the transition to EVs, electric vehicles?
That's a good question. I think the U.S. would like to be perceived as a leader in that.
Yes, right.
But you raise an excellent point. Where's the infrastructure? Where does that come from? Yeah. You can't just plug it in your garage to a regular, outlet. Like, oh, let me unplug the deep freeze and charge up the car.
The rolling outages that happen in California right now
already
are proof that if they follow Newsom's plan,
mm-hmm.
can you imagine the stress on that system mm-hmm. by 2030? Unless yeah. there are significant upgrades to the infrastructure, and they better get started now. They better get started now.
Well, and where does
I shouldn't say they all... we better get started now.
Yeah, you can happen. Say they. You can. Say they. We get it. And where does all that extra power come from? I mean, come on.
I don't know.
Unicorns on treadmills? Is there a flux capacitor patent out there that's awaiting approval?
You went exactly where I was going, to the flux capacitor.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Jumping gigawatts. Yeah.
I did see a DeLorean in a parking lot the other day.
Just don't get it up to 88 miles per hour and you'll be That's fine. Right. You'll be That's fine.
Right. So if the U.S. is a leader, and we are at least 10 years, if not 15 years,
mm-hmm.
so where does that leave Europe? Where does that leave the rest of Asia? Where does that leave the rest of the world on that transition? And we can't forget that in the meantime of the mm-hmm. next 15 years, let's just call it that, the ethanol industry has an unbelievably great opportunity to prove the ability of higher blends to reduce GHG emissions.
Well, yes, because we ended that conversation with Phil Flynn talking about how some of this clean energy stuff, great ideas, pie in the sky ideas, not economically viable, not feasible in most cases on a large scale. Not yet, yeah. anyway.
You know what is feasible?
Mm-hmm,
higher
mm-hmm.
blends of ethanol to reduce GHGs.
Exactly.
I keep going back to the ethanol town hall that we did with John Linder and Emily Score, when John said, John's president of NCGA, when John said, we continue to look for the next ethanol to help this corn market out. And he said, well, we tend to believe that the next ethanol is ethanol in the form mm-hmm. of the higher blends.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you got to build it from scratch.
Right. Yep.
You add on, you build up. And as you do that, you consume more corn to make more ethanol. And all of a sudden, John's making a lot of sense.
Yep.
Making a whole lot of sense. We got a supply and demand report coming up. We've got the expectations coming for you right after this industry spotlight. Joining us now is Steve Wilkins. He is the agronomy manager for Golden Harvest in the Eastern Belt. Steve, let's take a look back at 2020. Give us some specific yield results from Golden Harvest.
Yeah, thanks, Chip. So 2020, what a year, right? We had some really good performance in the central, midwest, to eastern corn belt. We had a couple 111, 112 day products specifically. I'll name out Golden Harvest G12S75 and 11V76. Then in some of our central to southwest Iowa areas, we're running well over 300 bushel. We move into the state of Illinois, we've got a dominant 110-day product in 10D21. And then as we move more east, we have a really strong another 110-day product in 10L16. All four of those, we're bringing 250 to 300, even 325 bushel per acre. And those are going to be really strong products for us as we build our portfolio going forward.
Yeah, excellent. What else are we looking forward to in 2021 from Golden Harvest?
One thing growers cannot fall asleep on heading into 2021 is corn rootworm and tar spot. We've got a very strong portfolio within Golden Harvest with our ag research traits, as well as our ability to understand the diseases, specifically tar spot, the genetic response to it, and quite frankly, how to manage it from our fungicide standpoint. We've got a great portfolio in our company, too, to handle it. So those are a couple of things to look forward to in 2021.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, hit us with some of your insect control varieties.
So what we like to highlight for corn rootworm would be our AgriShare Duracade products. We also have our 3122 options, which brings in the Herculex technology. So there's really not a challenged corn rootworm acre that our portfolio can't fit, and it's all under the brand of AgriShare Traits.
Gotcha. Where do we go for more information?
So you go to our website, goldenharvestseeds.com. You can also find us on Twitter and social media as well. So we're easy to get a hold of.
Excellent. Thank you, Steve. That is Steve Wilkins, agronomy manager for Golden Harvest in the Eastern Belt. All right, let's get ready for the supply and demand report. Okay, Davis?
Yes, T-minus 4 minutes and counting.
T-minus four. That's right. Now, in November, USDA put the corn carryover estimate for 2020-21 at 1.702 billion bushels. The average trade guess, according to a survey by Reuters, it has the corn carryover for the current marketing year at 1.691 billion bushels. So when you're talking about that much, it's steady. Steady is the expectation on the corn carryover. The risk here, I do not see them coming forward at this point and saying, you know what, we went too far with the corn exports last month. We need to back it off. Not with the industry saying, listen, 2.65 billion could turn into 3 billion before we're done. On the soybean side of things, here's a mover. In November, 190 million bushels was the estimate from USDA. The average trade guess, 168 million bushels, so down 22 million bushels. We talked about that earlier with Chad, what's going to be moving that around. On wheat, the average trade guess is 874 million bushels. That would be down from 877, so steady on the wheat carryover as well. On cotton, 6.89, this is according to a Bloomberg survey, 6.89 million bales, down from 7.2 million bales. That would be driven by a smaller crop. Hey, thank you so much for listening this morning. Thanks to all the guests that were on. You got to come back this afternoon. Davis and I are going to have the details of the USDA report. And tomorrow morning, free for all, Wiesmeyer Haney and Representative Cindy Axne. Thanks to Acuron Corn Herbicide for sponsoring the AgriTalk podcast. Talk to your retailer about how you can get 5 to 15 more bushels with Acuron. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron Yield Advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and University trials.